the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, and this morning on the program, Mary Beth Maziarz and I speak with cultural historian Elsa Richardson, who takes a deep dive into the history of what she calls the most fascinating organ, the gut. Stay tuned for that conversation. It's very interesting. And then therapist Natasha Daniels becomes highly vulnerable as she tells her memoir of having social anxiety, something that she counsels others to overcome. Her book is called Out of My Shell, Overcoming Social Anxiety from Childhood to Adulthood. This all coming up this hour on The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
Now, you've heard these recent scientific declarations. Our gut is our second brain, and our microbiome determines our entire existence, and things like this. Now, you know, that thing, the gut, how can this be? The thing that embarrassingly gurgles and bubbles and grumbles when we feed it the wrong things, or perhaps maybe have the wrong emotions. Well, our guest, Elsa Richardson, has written a whole book on the gut. It's The Curious History of the Gut, and she calls it the most fascinating organ. Elsa's an academic at the University of Strathclyde in Glasgow, Scotland, and she lectures on the history of medicine, among many other pursuits. And she joins us this morning to discuss her new book, appropriately titled Rumbles. Elsa Richardson, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, I think this book is pretty fascinating that you're really looking at, into, you go way back in history, the history of the gut. And we think that this is very current science that we're figuring out, calling the gut our second brain, and some people even call it our first brain, but that they've been talking about this for a very long time. How far back did we start considering what this sort of embarrassing organ was doing?
I think that as long as we've thought about our bodies in a serious way, we have recognized a connection between the gut and the brain. And the idea that it is new knowledge in any way, that our gut may be our second brain, or as you put it, our first brain, certainly doesn't hold up when you look into the history. So for example, to give a kind of very old example, I looked at the work of Galen, who's the kind of, you know, the famous archetypal Roman Greek physician. And he was convinced that the stomach possessed its own kind of intelligence. So for him, there was a kind of central ruling intelligence of the mind, sure, but he argued that the stomach had an intelligence which was separate from the mind. And the reason that he did this, or the grounds on which he did this, was that the stomach was capable of registering its own emptiness. And that for him suggested that it had its own special kind of brain power.
Wow. It was able to register its own emptiness. And by this, I assume that you're talking about that feeling we get when it's empty, and the possible sounds that come from, you know, the gut that's protesting, right?
To us,
to say, feed me.
Yeah, completely. And also, interestingly, Galen's recently, well, not even so recently, Galen's idea that, you know, that the stomach had this kind of autonomous intelligence was actually kind of backed up by hormonal science in the latter part of the 19th century, which discovered the enteric nervous system. So the nervous system which governs, gut. All things gut. And what, you know, the scientists who discovered that found out was that that can also, this nervous system, this part of our nervous system, can operate independently from the central nervous system, which again suggests this peculiarly autonomous region in the body.
My family has a lot of gut maladies. There's some Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, gluten intolerance, celiacs. Do you think that these are recent happenings based on, you know, all kinds of geo-modified foods and things, or have they always been around and we just understand them better?
That's a really good question. So, I mean, part of the impetus for this book came out of my work with a project called the Scottish Gut Project, which was looking at basically kind of trying to bring science and the humanities together with patients groups to kind of better understand, I guess, the way that kind of imagination, metaphor, and language impacts those who are suffering from gut conditions. So basically thinking about the kind of the power of, you know, how we describe how our gut is feeling in relation to a kind of more medicalized diagnoses. And, you know, one of the reasons that we got together and, you know, put this project, the Scottish Gut Project, together was based on the fact that in Scotland there are rocketing incidents of IBS, of Crohn's, of other chronic gastric conditions. So on the one hand, I think that it does seem that many of those, you know, types of conditions are on the rise, or certainly there seems to be good evidence of that. On the other hand, I think that when you look into history, what you discover is that the gut has long been a troublesome actor in the body. So I am by specialism a 19th and early 20th century British historian. And in my book, I describe this as a kind of, you know, as the kind of golden age of constipation, in a way, because everyone was, it does seem that everyone really had terrible problems with constipation in this period. There was a lot, you know, such a huge market for patent medicines directed at easing constipation. But not only that, there was an awful lot of fear and anxiety attached to the problem of constipation, right? So this was, I think, similarly with something like IBS today, many medical writers and thinkers described constipation as being in some way evidence that the speed of modern life and the nature of modern life was kind of overrunning our physical capacity to deal with it, right? So for someone writing the latter part of the 19th century, constipation, I think like IBS today, was seen as kind of evidence of the body's kind of protest against exactly the same things that we worried about now, you know, so processed foods, too much work, too much stress.
Wow, that's so interesting to think of it as a remark on what's happening in our world. I bet as a kind of a cultural historian, this is just totally right up your alley. And things like, you know, things like we're also hearing a little bit about leaky gut syndrome or brain fog related to things we eat. Do you think these are real conditions, or are they just ways people are trying to describe new things that are happening with the gut?
Leaky gut syndrome for me is extremely interesting. And I don't think I have any firm answer on whether this is quote unquote real or not. Certainly the scientific literature that I've read around it is fairly skeptical of this as a kind of, as an actual condition. However, for me, I guess as a cultural historian of medicine, it's really fascinating because it seems to me to be a revival of some of the ways that we've thought about our gut in the past as being a kind of storehouse of dangerous material. So specifically, in the book, I look at this figure, William Arbuthnot Lane, who was a very famous and respected surgeon working in the kind of latter part of the 19th century and early part of the 20th century. And he became really obsessed with constipation, you know, absolutely obsessed with the problem of constipation. And for him, the problem with constipation was due to something that he called auto-intoxication. So his idea being that when half-digested matter sat in the bowel for too long, it would begin to fester and then leak out poisons through the bowel walls into the rest of the body. And for him, that caused all kinds of mischief. So that might include things like, you know, cancer, infertility in women, you know, bad mood, brain fog, as you put it. And for Lane, you know, really this was kind of the problem of his age as he saw it. So for him, most conditions could be traced back to a kind of infrequency of bowel movements. And what I think is interesting with this idea of the kind of leaky gut, the leaky gut syndrome, is that I think it kind of frames the gut in a similar way, or understands the gut in a similar way, as being somehow a storage facility within the body that is filled with matter which is toxic to the body, you know, and which sees the gut as being a space that is kind of filthy and impure in the body, and which is always threatening to kind of, you know, burst its banks and release, you know, unwanted matter back into the system.
Hey, we warned you all that this was going to be a discussion about the gut. So
yeah, exactly.
We are ready to get grossed out. Our comments.
Well, exactly. It makes me wonder if in throughout history, there was all this discussion of the gut, and there was all this, say, fear around constipation, as you say. Was there a period of time that we decided that that was very inappropriate sort of talk? And we were hush-hush about the gut and the things that could go wrong with it, because it seems to me now that maybe until you get to a certain decade of age, that you just don't talk about these things, even now.
That's a really interesting question. I think that one thing that becomes apparent when you look into the history of the gut is how often our ideas, especially in a kind of Western context, our ideas of what it is to be civilized have been formed in reaction to or in relation to the gut and its products. So I'm thinking here of something like the Great Exhibition, which was staged in London in the mid-1850s, in which one of the kind of, so the Great Exhibition being this kind of massive display of Britain's, you know, colonial wealth, its industrial technologies, its arts, its crafts, basically this kind of great celebration of everything that Britain in the Victorian period thought of itself as being, right? Civilized, industrious, the pinnacle of, you know, the world in a way. And one of the most popular exhibits at the Great Exhibition, one of the most frequently visited and the most lauded exhibits, were the first flushing lavatories. So this, you know, the phrase, I don't know if this is very British specific, but I don't know if you've ever used the phrase spend a penny. So sometimes if you want to be polite in Britain and you say, you know, that you need to go to the bathroom, but you don't want to say that, you'll say, oh, I have to, you know, spend a penny. And basically that means, you know, I need to go to the loo. And that comes from the Great Exhibition, because they had these, you know, these, the kind of these first flushing lavatories that people were able to use. And in order to use them, you had to spend a penny to get in to use the lavatories. And I feel like, I guess that part of what I'm getting towards in terms of getting, thinking about the bathroom and the loo here, is the way that so often how we dispose of the kind of waste products of the gut comes in some way to signify more than that. It says something about our ideas of ourselves as civilized, right? This idea that to have a kind of clean, civilized city, for example, what is required is that all of the wastes of the body move underground in sewers, right? Are hidden from view.
Yeah. Spend a penny. I think I'm going to adopt that term. No, we don't have something like that. We say awkward things like, oh, I'm going to visit the ladies' room. Or
I think we can bring spend a penny back.
Well, some crude boys will say, I've got to go drop the kids off at the pool.
Oh, oh right, God. Right.
I do like that.
I can't even imagine what that means.
When I first picked up your book, Elsa, and by the way, we're speaking with Elsa Richardson. Her book is Rumbles, A Curious History of the Gut. That's the secret story of the body's most fascinating organ. Okay, historically, if I think about what I know from history and how the gut responds to things that we put in it or don't put in it, I think of two things, gout and scurvy. And they're very different in that gout was called, wasn't it called like the rich man's disease? Mm-hmm. Because it really came from eating all these very rich foods. And then scurvy, of course, is a lack of vitamin C. We think about sailors. They didn't know that they could just take one little slice of orange and they wouldn't get scurvy. But can you talk about those two things in particular, starting with gout? I think that's just fascinating.
That is really a good question. So gout, to speak to gout, I am obsessed with, and I think secretly in love with, an 18th century physician by the name of George Cheney. So George Cheney is one of my favorite figures from history. And he was trained in Scotland and then moved down to London to start up his business as a doctor, as a physician in the early part of the 18th century. And in that period, what that involved was a lot of wining and dining. So it involved, going out to dinner with possible patients, networking with your fellow doctors. It meant drinking a lot and eating a lot of heavy foods. Now, alas, poor George ended up in quite a state. So he found himself to be quite overweight. He was unable to walk unaided. He was covered in these like disgusting ulcers, as he describes it, from all of this kind of overeating. And he was, of course, plagued by terrible gout from all of this kind of overindulgence. And so what he did was he put himself on a diet, and he he restricted himself to, as he puts it, 1 pint of wine a day, which I think is I would say probably more than adequate for most of us now, but also a diet of just vegetables, milk, no meat, fruits, very kind of plain foods. And then in the guise of any good self-help guru today, he ended up writing a book in which he recommended this diet to his fellow, fellow Londoners, I guess, in this case. And he wrote this book called The English Malady, which he published in the latter part of the 18th century. And in it, and part of what is so interesting about him for me, in it, he describes this kind of national constitution or a national temperament, the national temperament of the English, as being melancholic. So we are, British people suffer from this terrible melancholy. And he suggests that one of the reasons for this is diet. Is down to diet. So he suggests that, this excessive diet of too much, rich and roasted meats, too much wine, too much overindulgence has basically led to a kind of nervous derangement in the nation, and which is causing all of this kind of, basically what we would now describe today as kind of poor mental health or low mood. Now, he sells this book, The English Malady, and on the grounds on which he sells it is that, to have this kind of nervousness, to be melancholic, to be gouty, let's say, is also a marker of a kind of social status, right? Because as you put it, gout is associated with rich and fine foods. So what's really interesting about The English Malady as a book is that it ended up selling melancholy as a kind of almost like a kind of fashionable disease. Almost like a kind of desirable disease, because to have it, it was a marker of status, a marker that you could afford, let's say, to be gouty.
That's a really fascinating story.
And then in terms of scurvy, I don't think I really have anything to say about scurvy, I'm afraid.
Oh, okay.
Nothing interesting anyway that I can think of off the top of my head. So,
well, our understanding of the gut, I discovered in your book, has its roots in some pretty horrific historical experiments on dogs. Mm. Aside from waking the world up to seeing animals as sentient feeling beings and drawing attention to some ethical issues of cruelty in animal testings, what did we learn from those experiments?
Mm. Well, I mean, beyond the issues of animal cruelty and, and the tragic fate of several very adorable brown terrier dogs. I mean, awful. Part of what we learned from those experiments, which were undertaken at University College London in the latter part of the 18th century by two physiologists, William Bayliss and Edward Starling. I think Edward Starling was married to William Bayliss's wife. So it was very Wait, let me start that again. Or just cut that. That doesn't make any sense. He was married to William Bayliss's sister. So it was all in the kind of family. So anyway, sorry, these experiments were undertaken by two UCL physiologists, William Bayliss and Edward Starling. And what they were doing in these with these experiments was attempting to, for the first time, map what would became known as the enteric nervous system. So this nervous system in the body that governs all of your kind of gastric processes, so digestion, absorption, all of that processing that goes on in the gut. And what they discovered and what became, was the most significant discovery was, one, they discovered the existence of hormones in the body. So before that, we didn't really know about hormones. And two, they discovered this close connection between, the operation of certain hormones and the work of the digestive system, the work of gastric process. So poor little dogs, certainly awful for them, but we did discover some quite important information from those experiments.
It sounds like it. And also, so if you're a lover of just kind of interesting cultural history, this book, Rumbles, will really appeal to you. There was also a fascinating section about cheese dreams. Do you feel that our food affects the way we dream or our subconscious?
That's a great question. Yeah, I do enjoy the cheese dreams. Part of what I find interesting about the cheese dream research, and I love saying that sentence, my cheese dream research, was the cultural differences which were flagged. So the British Cheese Board, get the pun, conducted this survey among British people and found that certain cheeses produce certain types of dreams. So they found, I think it's maybe it's cheddar encourages dreams of celebrities, Red Leicester, strange dreams, blue cheese, erotic dreams. I can't remember what it was, but basically different kinds of cheese seem to induce different kinds of dreams in the dreamer. But what other research has pointed to is the fact that this is not culturally consistent. So Brits and Canadians and Americans all report this kind of strong correlation between eating cheese and having quite kind of strong, nightmares or very vivid dreams at night. But Italians and the French do not report anything like this. So for Italians and French, two cultures which we would associate as, eating quite a lot of cheese and being quite pro fromage, do not seem to have this, do not seem to experience these kind of similar nocturnal events. And I guess part of what that might point to, which I think is extremely interesting, is the way that, dreams, though we might think of them as being, psychological or physiological, I think also have some cultural component, right? That they're also in some way formed by the culture and the society that we're sitting in. And I think that one of the things we might think about the stomach as doing is maybe kind of mediating between those different spaces. So between kind of the psychological, the physiological, and the cultural.
Well, I'm from originally from Illinois, which is adjacent to Wisconsin, which is the home of a lot of American cheeses. And I think that they should get on board with this idea and sell certain cheeses to promote certain kinds of dreams. Americans would jump all over that.
I'm completely behind that. I think a good English cheddar could do some work there too.
Gotta promote English cheddar.
Okay. Yeah, always. I gotta get, they're paying me.
Yeah, exactly. The cheese board.
The cheese board.
Well, it's funny when you talk about doing research that includes which type of cheese makes you dream, have this certain type of dream. It makes me wonder about some of the other types of crazy research that you found while researching your book on what happens in your guts. I mean, I would love to hear a soundtrack of what exactly is going on in the gut because it makes such strange noises. But does something come to mind about the crazy research?
Well, it's very interesting that you asked me that because it has been on my mind because I was at a festival, a literary festival this weekend, and I was speaking to someone who I shall not name because of the private things I'm about to reveal about them. But they were telling me that they had recently gone through a quite serious operation. Their intestines had become tangled. which is, you know, sounds incredibly disturbing. And one of the, okay, so firstly, first fact, the way that they deal with that as part of, as an operation, is they basically open you up and unspool your intestines out of your body and disentangle them. Then they have coat hangers that they hang around the surgical room, which they kind of hang your intestines up on.
Wait, this is current? Of like, just,
this is current. This was like 3 years ago that this operation occurred. Isn't that remarkable? Isn't that wonderful? Imagine all of your inside, really outside. Anyway, so he was telling me about this operation. And then I said, you know, like, how did they, you know, how did this come about? How was, what happened with the diagnoses? How was this diagnosed? And he said, well, you know, I went in and I had some stomach problems. And my physician said, right, okay, listen, I'm gonna listen to your stomach. So she kind of put a stethoscope up to his gut and gave it a good listen. And from just listening to the noise that his belly was making, she was able to diagnose correctly what was going on in there. Isn't that absolutely remarkable? So from just listening, she could tell that the intestines had become tangled.
Wow.
So I think it's really, it's fascinating. There's also this team in Australia who I talk about in the book who are, have been trying to perfect this listening. So have been developing this kind of gastric sonic belt that you can strap around your stomach and which would allow the physician to kind of more carefully listen to the modulations of the gut. And the reason that they're doing, the reason for this is that apparently IBS is extremely difficult to diagnose, that, or it takes a very long time to diagnose and involves a lot of kind of ruling other things out, let's say. And one of the easiest ways to diagnose IBS apparently is through listening to the gut and listening to the peculiarities and modulations that the stomach is making. So it's really remarkable, you know, what our kind of stomach rumbles might be able to tell us.
Oh, that is just fascinating. Okay, I'm going to try to think about through the rest of the day who you may have been talking to, because the fact that you didn't mention their name must mean that they're sort of a celebrity.
I just really hope they never listen to this program because I'm going to really be in trouble.
Absolutely. Well, this has been a fascinating discussion, and the book is equally fascinating. It's a mix of history and culture and health and everything about the curious history of the gut. The book is Rumbles, and our guest is Elsa Richardson. Elsa, thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life. This is really fun.
Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
15 million American adults have social anxiety. That's roughly 7% of the entire population. More than two-thirds of those adults showed their first symptoms during their childhood years, typically beginning around age 13. And many of those people live with social anxiety and don't get help, which can lead to other issues in their lives. Our next guest, Natasha Daniels, is a therapist who treats people with social anxiety, but she knows it so well, in part because she suffered from it herself. Natasha takes on the therapist's role with her past selves to drag her social anxiety out into the open. And it's all in her new memoir, Out of My Shell, Overcoming Social Anxiety from Childhood to Adulthood. Natasha Daniels, welcome back to The Mountain Life.
Oh, thanks for having me again. I appreciate it.
Well, not only are you very prolific with your books, we talked to you and less than a year ago, but now you're back with this very personal memoir. Was it part of sort of unlocking what you do as a therapist to examine in such detail your own social anxiety?
Yeah, I think I've spent so many years focusing on everyone else's mental health and using those tools for others. And even in my childhood, being in therapy sessions for my dad and my sister, that it was really therapeutic to turn the tables and say, okay, I'm gonna go give my younger self some therapy that they didn't get.
So you're going to have to address that saying that everyone has about therapists, you know, they're actually just solving their own problems. That's why they become therapists.
Well, maybe there's a truth to that. I don't know. There was a disproportionate amount of people with mental health issues in my graduate program. I think that drives people, and I think it also gives them insight on a personal level. Some of the best therapists, I think, have either their own mental health struggles or came from a family with mental health struggles that propelled them into that field.
I've noticed in that 7% of the population as saying that they experience social anxiety. That's a lot. Is it maybe time for us to reframe what social anxiety is and kind of address it as a different form of neurodivergence?
That's a good question. I feel like with neurodivergence, we're accepting and coming into ourselves with that struggle. You know, if you're autistic or you have ADHD, it's like, my brain is different than yours. With social anxiety, I never want to embrace my social anxiety. I want to understand it and I want other people to understand it, but it's not something that I want to be part of me. It's like having like your worst enemy in your brain, like narrating what you're doing as you're doing it 24/7. And that's not fun. It, you know, can lead to depression and hopelessness. And so I feel like when I think of neurodivergency, I think of embracing. I never want to embrace this.
All right. That's a really good differentiation. Well, what was it that sparked your desire to write this book?
It really kind of came out of a weird series of events. I was actually I was interviewing someone on my podcast who had written a memoir on panic. And so I had to read her book for the episode. And then I was like, oh my gosh, I love memoirs. This is fascinating. And so I started like dive into mental health memoirs. And then I'm like, oh, I would love one for social anxiety. And I couldn't find one. I'm just purely on social anxiety. Now I understand why. I was like, why isn't there one on social anxiety? Well, that's like the most naked you can be for sure. And so I decided I would write one that I thought it was a missing piece in the memoirs. And I think people with social anxiety feel isolated and alone. And to have a book that normalizes those experiences and identifies that would be huge for everybody.
Yeah. If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with Natasha Daniels. She has written a new memoir called Out of My Shell, Overcoming Social Anxiety from Childhood to Adulthood. And she talks about her own social anxiety in the book. So Natasha, before we go any further and into your whole world of social anxiety, I have a friend who's a therapist, and she was lamenting to me how we fail to distinguish between clinical anxiety and social anxiety. Could you explain the difference?
Yeah, I think people don't really understand social anxiety. You can be anxious and you can have different themes, you know, so you can have generalized anxiety disorder, you could have separation anxiety. And social anxiety is its own unique flavor because it's specific about the fear of rejection and criticism. At the core for most people with social anxiety, it's a feeling of not enoughness. And so you can have someone, and I've had parents say, how can my daughter have social anxiety? Like she'll go on the stage and she'll do like a ballet performance, no problem. People will say to me, how can you have social anxiety? You'll talk to like 1,000 people on a Zoom call. You seem relaxed. Well, I wasn't always. And it happens. It's very specific for each person as far as what situations are going to trigger those feelings of rejection and criticism. And also, I think people with social anxiety, some are pretty good at masking.
Yeah. Well, I would say that there are very few people that I have ever met who feel entirely comfortable and without any bit of anxiety when they say walk into a party alone with a room full of strangers. So, I mean, there are all varying degrees of this. And I guess my question is social anxiety disorder completely 100% treatable?
Yes. I think it is definitely. And I think it's the acuity of that. Going back to what you were saying, I think a lot of times, even my brother, when he read my memoir, he was like, well, don't we all have a little bit of social anxiety? Like who wants to go to a party alone or who wants to stand on stage and talk? Isn't that normal? And I think it's the level of, oh, it's normal. Do you lament for 24 hours afterwards how horrible that was? And then you get an anxiety attack the next time you have to do it. You have that too? Well, no, it's the severity. And I think that's the component that you can get relief from. You may never get fully rid of that critical voice in your head, but Can you learn to ignore it? Can you have an alternative voice in your head as well? And can you do things out of your comfort zone that you value and you want to do despite what social anxiety is saying? And that is yes, you can do that.
Mm-hmm. I loved the element of your book in which you do a little bit of a biological or biographical journey, separating your former selves into different parts of your life, the feisty Miss 6, the lonely Miss 14, defiant Miss 18. I did an exercise with a coach once where we had to write our life story in the third person. And sometimes I think that putting that, separating a condition or an event from yourself and your identity can go a long way. Is that part of the process that was helpful for you?
Yeah. And I mean, that is a therapy approach that I've used in my practice, you know, externalizing the disorder, that you're not part of the disorder. And I guess that goes back to your other question, right? Because you want to externalize it. In my book, I call social anxiety paro because it makes me paranoid. And then it's something I want to defeat. And then I get like a super Natasha 2.0 who's like coaching me and is encouraging me. But I think that externalizing is, these are not my thoughts. Like I don't have to like marry these thoughts and believe them, that I can question them and I can have an alternative thought. And yeah, I think externalizing that is such a powerful tool.
It really is. How do you feel that social anxiety affects energy? Because I feel I'm a pretty outgoing person in some settings, but other ones I come home and I'm just exhausted. I feel like I need to like just be alone and take some time. Is that something that you found affects you?
Yeah. And that's a great question because energy is such a big part of social anxiety. And I can tell what situations I'm uncomfortable with by how exhausted I am when I come home. Because sometimes, you know, you'll meet with someone or a group and you feel good in that group or you feel good in whatever role you were doing in that moment and it's energizing. So it's not about just being an introvert, but you could be in a situation where you're feeling like you're being judged or you don't fit in, and you're going to come home completely depleted.
Yeah, so interesting. So I did Toastmasters for a very long time. In fact, Mary Beth's husband was at Toastmasters with me, and it was always something that gave me energy that I felt afterwards, even if I felt like I flubbed a speech, it gave me energy and it made me feel good. And both of my sons would say that they have some bit of social anxiety, and I never understood it. I said, but wait a minute. And they had both even come to Toastmasters with me. Well, how do you know? And I'm wondering how my sons, for example, figured it out that they had social anxiety.
Well, that's a good sign, you know, that I think our youth are getting more educated on these things than maybe we did in the past. It's such a disruptive thing that's happening in your brain that you know there's something going on. And sometimes it's very specific. It might be in this particular situation, I'm going to blush or I'm going to lose control. And I can't do that. And so they could be great at giving speeches or going to Toastmaster or, you know, being athletic and performing and all that stuff. But it might be something very specific. Like if a teacher calls on me, I'm going to go into a full-blown anxiety attack. So I feel like it's great that they're recognizing that because it gets missed a lot.
I guess my next question would be, how do you figure out if it's impacting your life? I mean, is it enough to just say, I feel like if the teacher calls on me, I'm going to have a little panic attack? Obviously that's affecting your life. And it's, at what point do we need to jump into, you know, tackle this mode?
Well, I think there's different levels of tackling. Certainly, even if you feel like you have social anxiety and you're identifying it, whether it's clinical or not, I think working on that, working on feeling like you're enough, working on not needing other people's approval to feel whole is great for all of us. Everybody could benefit. When it gets clinical and you might need some intervention, you're not able to do the things that other people can do. It's impacting your daily functioning. Like when I started developing like a major fear of having to read out loud, starting in eighth grade history, he did this to me. It's his fault. But then I would drop college classes if they even remotely hinted that they were going to call on someone to read. And so I would get consumed with, you know, the teacher or the class, and it dominated my thoughts. I would stay up late at night thinking, do you think this teacher is going to call on me tomorrow? I don't know if I can go to class tomorrow. So it's that level of disruption that becomes then a clinical matter.
It's an interesting area that how social media and texting and things like that have affected social anxiety. I think back when the kids needed, when our kids needed babysitters, I found that they were dramatically more responsive via text than if you were to call them. Do you think that the proliferation of different communication styles is affecting the nation's social anxiety?
I think it's a mixed bag. I think there's areas where it's helpful, you know, because you can communicate and you can text and you can do things without necessarily having to like get out of your comfort zone. And as adults, you can order your groceries now. You can like literally stay home and have like DoorDash deliver your food. Like you can be agoraphobic and live a really great life. But then, you know, that there's the flip side to that. One, it's almost too easy. I mean, I think to hide. But for kids and teens and young adults and social media, all of that 24/7 access to you is draining. I couldn't even imagine having that much access, being in these group chats and thinking that you're missing something. They may be talking about you or feeling like you're missing out when you go on Instagram or TikTok and you're seeing, oh, they were at this party or they were together and they didn't tell me. It's just more material for your social anxiety to gnaw on.
Yeah, so it is a double-edged sword. It can help you out, but it can also probably keep you from developing muscles that might help you manage your way through the world. You mentioned that a lot of people start to have the first symptoms of social anxiety around age 13. If we notice our young preteen or teen starting to exhibit signs of that, are there any strategies that you'd recommend that we could put into place?
Yeah, I mean, I think 13 is a rough age anyway. So, I mean, who really enjoy, maybe some people enjoy their middle school years. I don't know. I have a 13-year-old right now and it's just awkward. It's an awkward time. I feel for her. But when you're seeing your kids have another layer of that discomfort, definitely working on their self-esteem is really where you want to start. A lot of times we think it's just about pushing them out of their comfort zone. Go make more friends or go do this or go to that party or go call somebody. And really it starts with them. Where do they not feel enough? Where are they feeling scrutinized? Where is their insecurities? And can we build that up and get their identity kind of more solid at a developmentally unstable period of time so that they can not have to seek other people's approval? I mean, that's really the goal, is to feel solid enough and feel like you're enough, even in that awkward time, that you're not looking for validation to the degree that you do with social anxiety.
As you talk, Natasha, it's making me think that it's more about building up our confidence than dealing directly with the thing that produces the social anxiety. So, as Mary Beth said, for the person who doesn't like to answer their phone because it gives them some degree of social anxiety, is something like exposure therapy, like forcing yourself to just answer your phone no matter what, the right approach, or what is? In your experience as a therapist, but also having dealt with social anxiety personally,
I think a lot of therapists will actually just start doing exposure therapy, you know, so they'll like develop a hierarchy and they'll be like, you're going to do these uncomfortable things that are maybe embarrassing or out of your comfort zone. And we're just going to go through the ladder, which is helpful. But I feel like a lot of times we're missing the first component, which is building the person up. The reason why we are so consumed with embarrassing ourselves in public or judgment or not belonging is because we don't feel solid within ourselves. And so that, I think that's the missing piece. I think working on yourself. So for me, if someone calls me instead of texts me first, I'm like, why are you doing that? Like, who does that? You know, and then I get angry because I'm like, there's an easier way to communicate with me. Like you could email or text, but really behind that for me, because you want to go back to like what's underneath that is if I get on the phone with you, one, I can't see your verbal cues. Mm-hmm. I mean, not verbal, your physical cues. And like, I really look at a lot of, I'm a visual person. I'm getting a lot of information. So I don't know if like that pause is because you're bored with me, you know, what's going on. And then two, how am I going to end the call? That I like the minute I start a call, I'm thinking, how am I going to end this? Who's going to end it first? How do we wrap this up? And so accepting, okay, this may be awkward, but you can handle it. Or let's practice on how you end a call. You know, those practical skills can actually reduce the anxiety.
I love that. I love that someone else thinks the same way I do about phone calls. And maybe it's ubiquitous. I don't know. And that's my problem, is my anxiety around that is being too direct with someone. Like, what can I do for you? You know, instead of going through this whole, like, all these pleasantries and what have you been up to? And it's 10 minutes later and you finally haven't gotten to the purpose of the call. That's my anxiety.
Yeah. So that may be a time issue. You're like, you're going to just, you know, take all my time and I don't want to offend you. Yeah.
Exactly. It's great.
You mentioned earlier that you kind of named your paranoid part, which I love. And was it Super Natasha that fights para? Okay. So what is Super Natasha? What's the mantra? What is Super Natasha doing to kind of help you through those tricky moments?
She didn't come on the scene for quite a while, and I think sometimes we have to really generate that other voice in our head. It's not natural for even other people without social anxiety, but she was an obnoxious, annoying cheerleader. She'd be like, first she forced me to do stuff. She'd be like, "Up, that's uncomfortable. You got to sign up for that." Or, "Up, nope, you got to stay. I know you want to get your phone out, but nope, you're going to leave your phone and you're going to just sit here." But then she also became a cheerleader where she would be like, "Who cares about them, Natasha?" Or like, "You're killing it, Natasha." And to have that voice in my head for the first time in 40 plus years, has started to become natural, where like now she's just there. And that's more of my internal dialogue than the negative. And that's just a really, really big shift to have that become organic and not forced, because I think initially you have to force that.
I love that balance that creates, though. We all are aware, in recent times of the inner critic, right? And when you're trying to create things, write things, make things, that inner critic is always kind of niggling at you. And I love the idea of having a kind of a badass cheerleader in place to counteract that. Well, memoirs are such, by nature, a revealing format. How did you approach the vulnerability that you needed to basically expose these parts of yourself that maybe aren't your favorite?
I wrote it almost like a fictional story. So that helped. I was, really into the craft of writing. I wanted to write something beautiful. I wanted to write it like it was a novel. And so that really helped me remove myself from the story to some extent, because I got stuck in the writing. Like, how do I describe that in a way that like people are going to feel it? And then I had a writing professor. She did writing classes. So I took her writing course while I was writing this book. And she always said, write it like no one's going to see it. And that was really good advice, because I'm writing about not only myself, but other people too. And so instead of thinking, oh my gosh, they're going to read this and they're going to get upset. It was just, I'm writing this to myself like I'm writing a fictional story. I convinced myself so well that when it came out and people started to be like, "Oh, and I read that part about," and I'm like, "Oh my gosh, I forgot this is actually going to be exposed." Little anxiety producing.
I'm a songwriter in another part of my life. And I tell the same thing to my songwriting coaching students, is that, write it as if you're never going to need to sing this song. This is not, just get as honest as you can get on the page. Mm-hmm. And the ironic thing is that the more specific and revealing and honest you are, instead of, eliminating people who can identify with it, they only identify with it more, because so many of us have these quiet parts of ourselves that we don't reveal. And so when someone does, you really feel that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Natasha, this memoir is something that, the vulnerability with which you had to approach this, you really feel comfortable now with it. Like, I would even contrast it with our previous interview that we did with you back in February or whatever it was, that you're really comfortable with talking about social anxiety disorder, your personal experience with it.
Yeah, I have. I feel like I've come into my own with it for sure. Yeah. And I think exposing it then makes me a little bit more empowered and confident, because it's like, now everybody knows I have it. So I don't have to hide it,
Absolutely. That's a really good point. I also just, by means of sort of wrapping up the interview, I wanted to make a point about being nice to ourselves and, you know, the whole inner critic. And I've been a professional interviewer now for about 13 years. And I remember how much I would lament over something that I said on live radio that didn't go right, or I stumbled over my words, or maybe I knew I made a grammar gaffe or something. And now, 13 years later, I just say, oh, you know, we all do that. So is it that my inner critic is under control, or I just have more confidence because I've been doing it for a long time?
Maybe both. You know? Maybe both, for sure. You just get thicker skin as well, where you're like, is it really that big of a deal? You know?
Exactly. Thick skin. Well, Natasha Daniels, it's been a pleasure speaking with you again. The book is Out of My Shell, Overcoming Social Anxiety from Childhood to Adulthood. It's a memoir. Natasha, thank you so much for joining us again on The Mountain Life.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.